It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, with our political analysts, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, where she's Associate Professor of Political Science in our Des Moines studio. Rachel, thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hans Hassel is with us, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. He took the trip down to our Iowa City studio. Thank you very much for coming in, Hans.
Well, it's a great drive, so I'm glad to be here.
Okay. Well, we have plenty on our plate, as usual, on this Politics Wednesday. A little bit later in the program, we want to talk about President Trump's latest executive orders, his initiative with the aim of supporting domestic products and workers. Behind that slogan, Buy American, High American. Later in the program as well, options for dealing with North Korea. The GOP's goal of major tax reform, and we had a few days ago the protests across the country over the president's refusal to release his tax returns, as presidents have traditionally done since the 1970s, I think, at least. But first, let's start off with your comment on last night, the Republicans escaping a potentially huge loss, perhaps more symbolically than actual practically. They are forcing a runoff in this closely watched Georgia special congressional election. A Democrat, John Ossoff, fell short of the 50% he needed in this huge crowded field. 18 people in this all-party primary, what they do there in Georgia. He'll now face the Republican and former Georgia Secretary of State Karen Handel not until June 20th. So this is significant in it is the place that was left when Tom Price became Health and Human Services Secretary. Let me turn to you first of all, Rachel. I guess Democrats tried to turn this into a referendum on Donald Trump. Were they successful even though they didn't, when they're now facing a runoff?
Well, they're claiming success. Both sides are claiming success here.
Of course, this is politics.
Of course, that's right. This is how it works, right? The Democrats had a clear stated goal, which was don't go to a runoff. Ossoff needs to take this with over 50%. He didn't do that. So now we move to a runoff. And we have another 2 months now of paying attention to Georgia's congressional politics, which I don't think anybody should be looking forward to. It's going to get nasty, I expect. A lot of money is going to go into Georgia. But in the end, I expect that the Republicans will be able to hold the seat.
Mm-hmm. Hans, with Donald Trump's low approval ratings, historically low in modern presidential terms, were you surprised to see the involvement the president had against the one Democrat on that all-in primary, robocalls, for instance?
I'm not that surprised. I mean, I think that if you look at that particular district, it leans Republican. If you look at Donald Trump's approval ratings among Republicans, they're still really high. And so I think that that's actually a fairly kind of standard thing for the leader of the party to get involved when he among his co-partisans, he's still pretty popular. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I want to point out about this that I think is really interesting is that I think that this really is a boon to Democrats in that it shows them and it gets them to be able to recruit better candidates for the upcoming elections, right? If you see this particular election that this is a plus nine Republican seat in general, and they're barely winning it, or they're barely avoiding a runoff in this case. You look at the Kansas special election that was a couple weeks ago. That was normally a plus 22 Republican seat that the Republican won by 8 points or something like that. And both of those suggest that this is a very favorable political environment for Democrats. And mm-hmm. I think that's going to be a boon to them, not necessarily in winning these elections, but in getting very good candidates to step up in the upcoming midterm elections.
Rachel, do you see it the same way, and also the same way in terms of prospects for 2018, the next big mile marker that Democrats have on their in their view?
Well, I do to some extent. I mean, while this particular district in Georgia is heavily Republican and has been for decades, so we should expect Republicans to do very well there. Much has been made about the fact that the district is not your traditional Trump Republican. So average income in the district is about $72,000. That's far above the national median. And Karen Handel is not a traditional Republican. quote-unquote Trump Republican either. She's much more moderate, although she hasn't, she has at least to some extent given lip service to the fact that she supports Donald Trump and she welcomes him to come down during the during this next phase of the runoff election. But nonetheless, this is not the Trump wing of the Republican Party in Georgia right now that we're looking at. So to some extent, you know, we should expect that Trump's numbers among those Republicans are not as high as they might be among other districts. Having said that, you know, Democrats are making some gains in these areas, but they're not winning yet.
Right.
You know, and while Ossoff, you know, has proven to be a really dynamic candidate, he also had $8.3 million to play with in a runoff election. That's a lot of money to play with in a primary election. And he's a virtual unknown. He's 30 years old. He's never held office before. So, you know, the degree to which candidates like Ossoff emerging in some of these districts across the country are going to change the fortunes for the Democrats in 2018 with a congressional map that heavily favors Republicans, I think we have a long way to go before we should make that series of assumptions.
Many politics day discussions before 2018's election.
Yes, we got a lot to talk about.
Okay, we'll leave that for now. If you just joined us, Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University, Hans Hassel of Cornell College, chewing over the latest on the political landscape. Yesterday, Donald Trump promised big wins in the next stretch of his administration.
Big wins?
He's now approaching 100 days. What is that? Next week, I think. 29th of April. In his speech yesterday, he hailed the opening days of his administration as a wild success. He pledged to quickly deliver on health care, tax reform, infrastructure. Here he is, a bit of his during a tour of Snap-on Tools in Kenosha, Wisconsin yesterday. Trump announcing a new plan to hire American and declared victory on delivering many of the campaign promises in the first 90 days of his administration.
No administration has accomplished more in the first 90 days. That includes on military, on the border, on trade, on regulation, on law enforcement. We love our law enforcement. And on government reform. Today, we're building on that optimism. And I'm proud to announce that we are about to take bold new steps to follow through on my pledge to buy American and hire American.
Okay, before we get to that latest executive order, Hans, when you listen to what Donald Trump says or tweets about his accomplishments, how does that match up with what you see actually taking place in the first 90, 95 days?
Well, I think it depends on whether you're looking at executive orders or you're looking at legislative progress. Executive orders are the weakest form of policy enactment, right? They can be overturned by both a court challenge and legislation. A lot of times they don't necessarily carry the weight of the ability to allocate money or to allocate more money to a specific cause. Or if I give the example of building the wall, he signed this executive order that advocated for, you know, refocusing on extending and building the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. And in reality, there hasn't been any appropriations from Congress to actually go do that. And so I think a lot of his claims here are based off of the executive orders that he signed. And I think that that's a very, you know, very narrow, very short-sighted look at what he's actually accomplished, right? You would expect a Republican with Republican majorities in both the House and Senate to be able to get through some substantial legislation. You look at past presidents who have had that sort of benefit, they've been successful at doing that. And I think that I'm not sure that you can necessarily blame Donald Trump for this, but I think that it says something about the state of the Republican Party as it currently is, with the divisions between strong conservatives, Tea Party, Freedom Caucus individuals, and those more mainstream Republicans who still expressed some trepidation about supporting Trump full-heartedly, and so I think that it's this division that brought down John Boehner, that has threatened Paul Ryan, that continues to exist and continues to cause problems for any Republican president. I think we'd be saying the same thing if it was Jeb Bush or John Kasich in office, because you'd have the same structural problems that would make it difficult to pass legislation within his own party.
Okay, so Rachel, you agree? Aside from executive orders, there's not much Donald Trump can accomplish without Congress. He has to get that patched up, right?
Yeah, right now, legislatively, in fact, Sean Spicer was asked about that this morning in the morning briefing, saying, hey, what are your legislative successes over these 100 days? And he said, well, we still have 10 days to go.
That was his answer.
Yes.
All right.
I'm obviously paraphrasing, but, Congress doesn't come back into session until next Monday. And then they immediately have to tackle a budget. Because government funding runs out on the 28th of April.
Does that give them a day, I think, left?
So they can fight over that. But I don't think we're going to see any major legislative accomplishments in the first 100 days. Trump has been very busy signing executive orders. And as Hans indicated, this is not a big show of presidential power. Executive orders can be overturned by courts. They can be overturned by legislators. They can be overturned by future presidents,
as we're seeing right now with the Obama executive orders,
exactly.
One after the other. They're like ducks in an arcade at the fair, right?
Yeah. Many of these initiatives that he's taking credit for, he's taking credit prematurely, right? Because until we see congressional action, particularly on appropriations, these effectively, they're much more symbolic than they are substantive.
Yeah, I mean, one other thing I would want to point out is I think that we have this kind of this arbitrary 100-day period that stems from FDR's initial action in those first 100 days. But I think that that's really a bad time frame to judge a presidency by. And so, I think what you really want to look for is in the coming year, what do we see additional progress towards some of these goals? Do we see some ironing out some of the differences? I mean, it's one thing to try to ram something through. It's another thing to try to craft good legislation that's really going to win the support that he needs and to become that bridge builder. And we'll see what he can do. I mean, right now it does not. You look at the healthcare debacle; it doesn't really look like he's going to be that type of president. But there are other presidents that have struggled in the first couple of months and have righted the ship. And so maybe he's able to do that as he learns going forward. Right, this is an individual who has never held political office before, doesn't understand some of the political negotiations needed. And so, therefore, maybe he'll learn as he goes, as he gets more people experienced and understands what is really needed to get good quality legislation through the system.
I agree completely on that. I would add, I think that the upcoming debate on tax reform is going to tell us a lot about where the Republican Party is and the degree to which these factions within the Republican Party can ultimately come together to work on common goals, or if they are so factionalized at this point that meaningful substantive legislating is going to be difficult.
Let's get to that tax reform overhaul question in just a moment, but let's address the executive order that the president issued yesterday, a review of a visa program that he said has undercut American workers. It's a review of what is called the H-1B program. That would be a transitional step, according to the White House officials, towards a revamped immigration system. Reaction to this latest executive order, Rachel?
Well, the H-1B visa program has been controversial for a number of years. These are the visas that are supposed to bring highly skilled workers into American corporations, and particularly tech companies use them to bring the most highly skilled necessary workforce into the country. And what has happened over time is that a number of outsourcing companies overseas have become very good at gaming the system. There are 85,000 visas in total that are handed out through a lottery system. And so these outsourcing companies, they provide cheap technical labor, and they apply for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of visas every year, and they get a number of them. Just sheer, if you're just talking sheer odds, right? They submit so many applications that they get a large number of these. But it undermines the original intent of the H-1B visa program. And so, so the, you know, a lot of people have recognized that this program needs to be evaluated very closely, and that some reform might be necessary. So I don't think there's going to be a whole, you know, how the reform happens is, of course, where the controversy comes in.
This is
the
just
need
a...
for reform, I think, is pretty universally recognized.
Ordering this review of the H-1B program, this is for the high-skilled workers here. Critics, though, noting when the president does this, he is not cutting back on other guest worker visa categories, such as the H-2B program for low-skilled non-agricultural workers. Which he uses at his Mar-a-Lago estate. So an obvious open there for his critics.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Hans.
Jump in there.
I mean, I think that this is right. You also have to think about what is this strategically in terms of where the criticism is. I think that you could portray this as a political move and as an economic self-benefit move. But I think that either way, he gains a lot of political capital among his supporters for doing this and addressing this particular question. Immigration is a hot topic among Republicans, something they really care about. And so, by taking this symbolic step, he's really able to reach out to his constituents and gain this support in doing this. One of the interesting things that I've found previously in some of my own research is that the more media coverage there is of immigration, the more white Americans are actually more likely to identify with the Republican Party. As we get more and more of this coverage, right? So you direct this coverage around this particular topic, it's going to get more people focused on, people who are not using these visas correctly, who are here illegally, who are doing things that they shouldn't be doing while they're here, and all of this news coverage generates a sort of racial threat among white Americans, which drives them more towards the Republican Party. So this is actually, politically advantageous of him to keep this in the news because it makes them more aware of this particular threat. To their perceived threat to their way of life, which makes them more likely to identify with Republicans who are this anti-immigration party.
Hans and Rachel, before we go to break, I want to have your reaction to what the U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has been doing regarding immigration. Let's listen to a little bit of our Attorney General in a news conference last week. Jeff Sessions directed federal prosecutors across the nation to make immigration cases a higher priority, to look for opportunities to bring felony charges against those who assist others to cross the border illegally, assault border officials, and use illegally obtained identification documents. Let's listen to the Attorney General.
For those that continue to seek improper and illegal entry into this country, be forewarned. This is a new era. This is the Trump era. The lawlessness, the abdication of duty to enforce our laws, and the catch-and-release policies of the past are over.
So, Rachel, what do you make of this more aggressive posture put forward by the U.S. Attorney General?
Well, quite literally, there's a new sheriff in town. one of the really interesting things that's happening here is that the Department of Justice, signified, of course, by the role of Jeff Sessions, Attorney General, is getting the lion's share now of publicity and work related to immigration. This is a shift. Usually it's Department of Homeland Security that primarily heads up immigration enforcement because a series of agencies are housed in the Department of Homeland Security. But the idea of shifting authority to the Department of Justice, and particularly of directing prosecutors within, under the purview of the Department of Justice. And I should note that, remember that they fired all of the U.S. attorneys.
Right.
So there are 93 U.S. attorneys that still have to be appointed. So who exactly is being directed is a big question right now. We don't know the answer to that.
Also, one of these former U.S. attorney generals asks this question, and I think perhaps a different framing. The former U.S. attorney general under the Obama administration said, which prosecutors and agents does the attorney general want to divert from growing threats like terrorism, cybercrime, the opioid and heroin trade, organized crime, and cartel activity? So this is a matter of priorities. You're announcing there, Hans, aren't you? People crossing the border illegally now go above the cybercrime, terrorists, those in the heroin and opioid trade?
So this is fascinating. In my Introduction to American Politics course, we talk about bureaucracies being agents of Congress and the presidency. And agents... the principals in this case may have a different goal than the agents. The agents have a desire to do things that are going to continue to enable them to support their jobs and to do other things. And so in this case, this may be an instance where the goal of border control is to do all of these things that you just mentioned. But there are certain aspects that are going to bring them more attention, are going to probably increase their funding, given that we have Republicans in Congress and in the White House. And so by focusing on those particular aspects, you are enabling and strengthening that particular agency, because they're going to do these high-profile things that their principals want them to, and they're going to get more funding as a result. And they're going to perhaps leave those other things aside. And that's it, right? We have to recognize what the incentives are for these individuals, right? This incentive right now is if they want to increase their funding, is to focus on this initiative that Republicans in Congress and the president that care about, even if that means perhaps setting aside some of these lower-profile activities that they're supposed to regulate and to monitor. And so this idea here of focusing on one aspect of their job over another to increase their kind of clout within the administration and their ability to get increased funding, I think is, yeah, they're going to have to set some of those things aside. But perhaps those things aside is for them, it's good, because it's going to enable them to get more funding. Perhaps for the American people, that there's a consequence there. But for them, as an agent, as someone who's being rewarded for what they're doing, that's probably a good thing.
Rachel, we have a few seconds before we go to break. Anything to add to Hans's comments there?
Well, I would agree on the whole. I mean, this is what government agencies do. Jeff Sessions, of course, also has a set of incentives here. He, among Trump's very first supporters, he sees a role for the Department of Justice. He wants to assert that role, and he's empowered to do it right now. The degree to which these are going to, this policy change is going to result in sweeping changes, we don't know yet. We have yet to see how it will be implemented.
We'll be back with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University and Hans Hassel of Cornell College on this Politics Wednesday edition. When we come back, we'll talk about tax reform, long promised as a major goal of the Republicans. And hope you have your taxes in. That was yesterday, wasn't it? Taxes go in. Also, the protests over why Donald Trump, unlike presidents going back several decades, will not release his tax returns. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're back midstream in this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow on this program, shootings have flared up in parts of Iowa in recent years. But what happens when gun violence and violence in general are viewed not only as a matter of law enforcement, but also as a public health issue? Tomorrow on this program, a recent panel discussion that I moderated, including Dr. Lena Wen, health commissioner for the city of Baltimore, known for its gun violence. And she's been in that position now for a couple of years, and we'll share how Baltimore is tackling its problems of poverty, gun violence, and addiction as public health issues. That's tomorrow on this program. Today we have with us Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College, in our Iowa City studio, Rachel Caulfield in our Des Moines studio, associate professor of political science at Drake University. As we chew through the latest on the political front, we'd like to have you join us as well. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. And you could also tweet us at IPR Talk. And we want to talk about a number of things this half hour, the options the U.S. has in North Korea. Also, perhaps talking a little bit about where the Affordable CARE Act replacement is, what the plans are there, about a month after the Republicans failed to unify behind an alternative plan to replace the Obamacare, as it is also known. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about tax reform initially here this half hour. It's been a major goal of the GOP, Hans and Rachel. We have the U.S. House Speaker with the Ryan plan, a sort of a tax blueprint, approaches also from the White House, from the Senate. This, as a reminder, would be the first major tax overhaul since, I think, the mid-1980s. Excuse me. What is the status of this, Hans, of the GOP pursuing this goal?
Well, it's still in very preliminary stages here from what I've heard. There's still a lot of negotiation going on among Republicans trying to figure out what exactly is going to be there. Is there going to be a payroll tax reform in here? Is there going to be import-export taxes and those sorts of things that they need to clean up? And what exactly do they want to get in here? I think that President Trump had originally set an August deadline of some sort. Of trying to meet that before Congress goes out to recess in the summer. It's looking less and less likely that they're going to make that deadline. We often think of the bill process as this nice formalized schoolhouse rock, right? It goes to committee, and then it goes to subcommittee, and then it goes to the floor. In reality, the legislative sausage making is a little bit more messy and involves a lot of negotiation on the upper levels, and often you get kind of a bill that's put together and then outside of these formal mechanisms and then rammed through the process. And so I think that they're still in this process of the sausage making, of figuring out exactly what's going to go in there. And there's still a long ways to go, right? You've got constituencies, business constituencies that really have a significant would be strongly affected by this, and so they want to make sure that it's not going to harm them, and it's not going to harm the people that are strong supporters of the Republican Party and that core constituency. You don't want to do something and all of a sudden realize, hey, wait a second. This group of people are really upset about this. This is exactly what happened with the American Health Care Act, and so they're trying, I think, to get all their ducks in a row rather than try to ram this through.
We yesterday, of course, millions of Americans meeting a tax return deadline. However, White House spokesperson Sean Spicer reaffirming this week that Donald Trump would not release his tax returns, as presidents have done since the 1970s. Traditionally. There's no law that says a president has to do this,
nope.
Right? No?
Nope.
Okay. Well, this is interesting. This past weekend, after wishing everyone a happy Easter via Twitter, President Trump spent the morning of Easter Sunday tweeting against protesters who gathered across the country, many thousands who gathered across the country, to demand to see his tax returns. The president's tweet verbatim, "I did what was almost an impossible thing for a Republican. Easily won the Electoral College. Now tax returns are brought up again." And it goes on, "Someone should look into who paid for the small organized rallies yesterday. The election is over." End of the quoting of the president's tweet there on Easter Sunday. Rachel, your thoughts on the protests across the country and also the president's reaction here.
Well, what better way to spend Easter Sunday morning than tweeting at the protesters, right? So this is, first of all, from a tax reform perspective, I think if the Republicans had the semblance of a plan, this week is the perfect week to put it out. They clearly don't. And so we're all waiting with bated breath to find out what elements might make it into a final bill. There's a lot of negotiations backstage going on right now, I'm sure. And it'll be interesting to see how that all comes together and what the Republicans think they can agree on. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that Donald Trump's taxes then become a really big deal, and yes, he won the election. He can keep tweeting it, but I think we've all got that message now. He won the election. He did it without releasing his tax returns. Having said that, this is going to continue to be a point of argument in that without looking more closely at his tax returns, it is impossible to know the extent to which reforms that are being proposed by the president could potentially result in benefits for his companies and for him personally. And so, you know, a lot of that, those potential conflicts of interest could be addressed in a very upfront way if people had a chance to simply look at how he structures his own taxes, what sorts of deductions he takes now, how these changes might affect his business. If he had wholly and completely separated himself from the businesses, then that would be a different story. He hasn't done that. You know, his sons are now running the Trump Organization, but they've made very clear that they do update their father on business operations. So as long as we don't know what's in those taxes, Trump is going to continue to get this line of argument, particularly as we head into a season of tax reform discussions.
I mean, I think this is a no-win situation for Trump, though. I mean, if he doesn't release his taxes, he gets, you know, hit over this and he gets beat up in the media about it. If he does.
He'll get beat up in the media.
Right. So, I mean, I think that he's basically saying, I think he's taking a strategic plan here of, right, let's make this less about how does this benefit me and more about what the merits actually are. And I think that there may be something to say about that. I mean, I think that people generally have this expectation, this norm that presidents are not supposed to benefit off of the presidency financially. And I think that, I mean, I'm not sure that's necessarily true, but I think that there's this expectation that they should be doing what's in the best good. And without seeing that information, it's very hard, and people are hesitant to trust him and believe him as a result.
I wanted to ask you too about the other major legislative goal that the Republicans had first out of the chute. That was the repeal, replacement of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, also related to this tax reform issue. But first of all, let's listen to our Senator Charles Grassley at a constituent meeting here in Iowa yesterday. He said that recent news that, and we reported on this plenty here on Iowa Public Radio, that two companies will stop selling individual health insurance policies in the state, and the failure to get a new health care law signed are things that concern him. Let's listen to Senator Grassley.
Republicans better get cranked into action and not do like the House of Representatives did 3 weeks ago. Get something passed and get it to the president, get it signed so that these insurance companies have some certainty and they stay in business and are willing to do business through the exchanges.
Okay, so it's been about a month since the GOP failed in Congress to repeal and replace the ACA. What I find remarkable there, react to this cut of the senator showing concern for the health insurance marketplaces put in place by the Affordable Care Act. It brings up the question: who would be, held politically accountable for the future of the Affordable Care Act, unless if it's not replaced, Hans?
Well, I mean, I think it's very difficult. I mean, it's very easy to take something away that some people don't actually have, right? So that before you had the implementation of Obamacare, there was a strong sentiment against any sort of change, right? We're risk averse. We don't want to go to a new system that we don't know what's actually going to happen. And I think you've got the same sort of sentiment here now. And what Senator Grassley, I think, is expressing is we don't want to lose something that we do actually have, right? We need to implement a system. We need to make changes so that people can maintain the service that they currently have. And I think that's what he's expressing. He's saying we've got these health insurance companies that are backing out of the marketplace. Where are these people who had health insurance going to go? Right, we need to make sure that these people maintain their coverage. Right, there's this concern for his constituents, and I think that he's right in expressing that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we do not have a Congress appeal, have a repeal and replacement ready to go. If it's incapable of doing that, Rachel, could you imagine a GOP ever getting to the point of supporting fixes to the current ACA?
Well, they may have to. So one of the reasons that they put healthcare front and center is they wanted big savings from healthcare reform before they went into the tax reform fight. So they see two fundamental ways, from a policy perspective, two fundamental ways to cut the federal budget, thereby allowing them to enact a tax credit or reduce taxes, however you'd like to think about it, or reduce taxes for middle-class Americans as well as companies and corporations. One of those was savings from reform of healthcare, and another is the reform of import and export taxing. So they wanted, you know, they need to see those savings in order to make tax cuts revenue neutral. That's not working out for them right now. I think what Grassley is expressing is exactly why the Healthcare Act, had it gone on to the Senate, would not have succeeded in the Senate. You got a lot of senators who are charged with representing states where you have a few providers that are heavily dependent on the current system, and you have a lot of constituents who are heavily invested, therefore, in the success of the current system. And, you know, you have a few ideological, really strong ideological forces in the Senate, but on the whole, the Senate tends to be a more moderating institution. And so, you know, it doesn't surprise me that Grassley came out and made these comments. I think going forward, the Republicans are going to have to figure out how to navigate the healthcare debate. One option is to kind of work within the existing system and try to reform it. But I think you're going to lose a lot of other Republicans once you start going down that road.
Let's take a quick call from Tom in Des Moines, who's listening, before we move on to a couple of other items before the hour finishes off. I'll ask you to be brief, Tom, but certainly welcome to the program.
Thank you. I think the Republicans are having such a hard time replacing Obamacare because all the good Republican ideas have been used by Obama. I think that the free market that should be publicly talked about is the market that allows everyone to participate. But there's a certain segment of the Republican Party that says, no, the free market is the market that has no regulations. And so that is what's being at play here, is that extremist version of Milton Friedman type of version of the free market is running up against the idea of the free market that we all want to see, one where everyone participates, which is what Obamacare provides, at least to a great degree.
Well, the Republican narrative on Obamacare was that it was government-run health insurance, which...
But that was a false narrative.
Right, it is. But it was a successful narrative that was driven home in the minds of many Americans, evidently. Comment, Hans, Rachel?
The Obamacare originates out of this Cato Institute plan, and so it's branded as Republican. Governor Romney in Massachusetts institutes a Massachusetts healthcare plan that's very similar. Romney being, of course, the Republican candidate for president in 2012, but it's the differences here obviously are that the health care, the Massachusetts plan was in an individual state, so it would have been allowed to. Romney says, well, you would want to tailor these to individual states rather than have a national government a plan that is supposed to fit everybody. And so I think that's – to say that it's a Republican plan, no, maybe not. It's a conservative plan. It originates out of a conservative think tank group. But as a Republican plan, I don't think that it's ever been a Republican motivation.
Let me ask you to jump across to the other side of the world with your analysis, Hans and Rachel, as we end this hour. Today in Japan, Vice President Mike Pence – said Washington would work with its allies in China to put economic and diplomatic pressure on North Korea. But he added also today that America would defeat any attack with, in his words, an overwhelming response. So he's in Tokyo yesterday and leaving there from South Korea, reassuring the South Koreans of the U.S. commitment to reining in North Korea's nuclear and missile ambitions. Let's listen to a little bit of Mike Pence while in South Korea this week, warning North Korea against any further nuclear or missile tests.
We hope to achieve this objective through peaceful means, but all options are on the table. Just in the past 2 weeks, the world witnessed the strength and resolve of our new president in actions taken in Syria and Afghanistan. North Korea would do well not to test his resolve.
Okay, Rachel, how do you view the vice president's comments with the backdrop of all that's been going on, the heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, so this is a presidency that is very much focused on the military might of the United States and kind of restoring the military might of the United States. And you hear from Vice President Pence there some of the same messaging that we're hearing from President Trump, right? That when we talk about American power, we talk about how America will deal with crises abroad. We talk about military power. But I think right now, one of the things that we're seeing is why the State Department is so important, because that role, diplomacy, there is no great military option in North Korea. It just doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. The question there, what does it mean in practical terms to solve the North Korean problem? What does that look like, right?
We don't know.
Right? I mean, I think that you see China running into this problem as well, right? They don't want a destabilized state there, and so the question is how do you negotiate in a way that that doesn't cause that state to break down, but also provide some sort of security for the rest of the world? And I think that's really the question. It's a delicate situation because you can't take out the Korean government, the North Korean government, but at the same time you don't want to empower them either to do some things that they might regret or we might regret later.
So do I hear you saying, so we have this military might messaging, we have this posturing by the United States that is different than the Obama administration, a different approach. But is there any different outlook for reining in North Korea's nuke program?
I mean, you look at the statements by President Trump, advocating that China take a stronger lead on this, and I think that he realizes that the ability of the United States to affect change in that region is small, and it's not going to be through military means. And yes, he's not ruling that out, but I think that most individuals, most people would want a different solution, one that doesn't cause those that cause other problems down the road and get us into other messes that are similar. And I think that's commendable. One of the things that is kind of interesting is seeing how this is going to affect the Chinese-U.S. relationship, and that's going to be interesting as we ask them to take a bigger role and as they oblige. That's a positive look for relations with China.
Mm-hmm. I wondered if you had any comment about this curious revelation this week that when Donald Trump announced early last week he had sent an armada, in his words, to as a warning to North Korea, the aircraft carrier strike group, I think the Vinson, that he spoke of, was still far from the Korean Peninsula, and it was headed in the opposite direction and would be not heading toward the Korean Peninsula for many days. So more than a week after Donald Trump says he ordered this strike group to the Korean Peninsula, we hear from the U.S. Military Specific Command that now they are proceeding as ordered to the Korean Peninsula. How do you interpret that? I mean, it's there are a lot of questions there, and I guess it's just interesting that was this a mix-up? Was this intentional? Does this erode the Trump administration's credibility during a time of high international tension around the Korean Peninsula?
I think it puts higher necessity on back channels, right? You've got the executive to executive communication, but you also need, in a good diplomatic relationship, we'll have lots of other relationships between ambassadors, between members of the Foreign Service. Those relationships, I think, are going to be much more important now that it's clear that what President Trump says is not always what is actual reality. And we've seen this here. We've seen this in other in a lot of different things on the campaign trail of instances where he's blowing things out of proportion or he's saying things that are actually completely false. And I think that these foreign diplomats are recognizing that now and are learning what the American public learned all throughout the course of the campaign, that maybe we can't take his statements at face value and we really need to double check this sort of thing. So I think this really puts a lot more pressure on the State Department and these kind of lower level diplomats that do establish communication through other means besides this formal press release announcements that the president makes.
A few seconds left. I'll give the last word to you, Rachel, about this or another political topic.
Well, I guess one of the things here, this is not just communication with the North Koreans, right, or the Chinese. This is communication with the American people and kind of making clear to the American people what our intentions are and how the president chooses to deal with international threats. And, you know, I think among those who support Trump, we have people who are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt at all, you know, at all costs. And I think they would say, you know, this may have been a mix-up, this may have been a miscommunication. Among those who don't support the president or are not naturally inclined to support the president, I think you do have a credibility gap here. And North Korea is going to be a long-standing problem, particularly because there are no good military solutions.
We'll have to end it there. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Hans Hassel of Cornell College, thank you for coming into our studios today. Always great to have you. You make a great team here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Also help from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, a community conversation on violence in Iowa. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hope you're back then.